Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Tzadikayim with Bet, 15 lines up. Amar Rav Ashi, Kavinim Beit Rav Kahana, when we were in the Beit Midrash of Rav Kahana, Yibayilon, this was the question that we raised. The Rabbi Shimon, the machloka that we saw above between Rabbi Huda and Rabbi Shimon, machloka Tanaim, how we deal with Shevach, Shal Gabe Agzela, where Rabbi Shimon said, Damar the Mechsa, the Shlish, Ula Revia, basically he becomes a business partner in the deal, and therefore the Gazlan gets a percentage of the Shevach as if he was an active partner in the bringing about of the Shevach, and the owner, the original owner, was the silent partner, who the Shakil Gazlan. So that is what the Gazlan gets. Ki misalkinan leit, when you have to remove him, when you have to pay him off. Bidmei misalkinan leit, can you pay him off with cash? Odilma bibisra shakil, or maybe he really has rights in the animal itself. So when he is getting paid off, the Gazlan, has he really earned a right inside of this animal to the point where the Nigzal, when he pays him, has to give him a portion of the animal and he can't just pay him off? Or is he allowed to pay him off with cash and then take the entire animal for himself? And we answer that question, or we try to resolve this issue from the following. There are three individuals for whom which we determine the accreted value or the additional value that is there. And they're cashed out. They don't get to keep anything, but you cash them out based on that shevach. Veluhen, and these are they. Bechor li pashut. A bechor and a pashut. Here you have a case of inheritance, where you have the bechor gets a double portion versus the pashut, who only gets a single portion. So if you're talking about three portions, the bechor gets 2/3, and the pashut gets 1/3. But that's only to what that which is available at the time of the death of the father, when they're yoresh. If after that fact, the property was improved, invested in, or had shevach associated with it, there the bechor does not have a right to a double portion. He only has a double portion to what's available at the time of the death of the father. That means for all the value that was created after that point, they are 50-50 partners in it. So now what's going to happen is they're going to split the property, and the bechor is going to get 2/3, and the pashut is going to get 1/3. But that's not a completely correct assessment of what they're supposed to get, because whatever happened post the death of their father really is a 50-50 split. So what the Bechor does is not that he has to give him a portion of land to make him whole, but rather he cashes him out. So say, for instance, it was worth 99 at the death of their father. That means that 66 would go to the Bechor, and then another 33 would go to the Pashut. If after that point in time, it also garnered additional value, that would say another 50 shekel of value, that 50 shekel in value, you do not split 2/3 and 1/3, but rather you have to split it 50-50, 25 and 25. That means that the Bechor is really entitled to 91, and the Pashut is entitled to 58, because of the 50-50 split on top of the 2/3 and 1/3 split. So now what we're going to do is we're still going to split the property along the lines of 2/3 and 1/3. But then the Bechor will have to then pay back to the Pashut the additional value. It'll be the extra out of that 50% that the Pashut is entitled to. He's already gotten 1/3 of it. So he's gotten 33 of it. He has to get then the additional 17%. That little piece, he has to pay out of cash. He does not have to give him land, or they don't redivide the land in order to get to that equitable division. Ubal chov lelokeach. And similarly, a creditor to a lokeach. The creditor here is coming to collect property because the debtor did not pay back the loan. The debtor already has sold the property to a buyer. Now, the buyer knew that when he bought the property, that there's a possibility that he'll be foreclosed on because the debtor will default on his debt. So the Baal Chov is allowed to go and take the property. That is his lien on the property. He goes and takes it away from the Lokeach. But in the meantime, the Lokeach added value to the property, which is not necessarily the entitlement of the creditor. The creditor is entitled to the underlying land. He's not entitled to the Shevach, the value that was created afterwards. So what the Baal Chov does is he goes and seizes the whole property. When he seizes the whole property, then he has to make whole the buyer, the Shevach. He doesn't leave him a piece of land for that. He pays him out in cash. He takes the whole land and pays him out in cash for the amount of Shevach that exceeds the value of the land. Baal Chov the Yitomim. And similarly, a Baal Chov that seizes from the Yitomim, again, he's entitled to the property itself because the father was indebted to him, and he has a lien on that prior to the death of the father, so that he has a right to. But the shevach, the extra value that was created after the death of the father, belongs to the yatomim, and he doesn't have any rights to that. That excess value is given to the yatomim. He can cash them out. He does not have to leave them a piece of land in order to do that. So those are the three instances where we see that you can cash out. But what you see from this, so then we see from here, which is what we're after, is trying to understand when you are in some way have shevach, what happens with the shevach? So here's the question was asked about a gazlan. And by a gazlan, we're saying, does he get the shevach, mean that he keeps a portion of the animal? Or is the shevach a cash out? And so basically what we're saying here is that it's the equivalent of the cases that we're bringing. So what we're seeing from here is that you do cash him out in these situations. This is the answer to your question based on what we're saying over here, is that whenever there's shevach involved, we cash the individual out. They don't get a portion of the item. So I'm Amalei Ravina the Ravashi. So then we get sidetracked a little bit. Mi Amar Shmuel Balchov Lelokeach Yayiv Lei Shevach. Since when does the Balchov have to give the shevach back to the buyer? Here you have a case, again, where the buyer bought it from the debtor, knowing that the creditor had a lien on the property. And now the creditor is coming and foreclosing. He's seizing the property because the debtor defaulted on the loan. Who says that the lokeach, the buyer, is entitled to that shevach? How do you know that the balchov doesn't get the whole thing? V'amar Shmuel, balchov govet shevach. We have a statement from Shmuel that indicates otherwise, which is that the balchov takes the whole thing with the shevach. Meaning the lokeach has no entitlement here whatsoever. Depends on the nature of the shevach that is here. The way Rashi translates the Megillah Ketvayim is kagon tvua shegadla kol tzorcha. Talking about tvua that is fully mature. Then he has to either give the produce to the buyer or he has to cash him out of the item. Tosfot already asked kasha on Rashi. Says mashma. He's only there to collect from things that are need the karka. And so therefore, that's what Tosfot says over here. The shevach ha-magia le-ketfayim kored davar she-sofo li-talesh ve-lisa be-ketfayim. Something that you eventually will uproot and carry off. Afilu kagon pagim bo-boser de-tzricha li-ara. Has nothing to do with the fact that they are dependent or not dependent on the land. The way that it seems from Rashi over here, is that once it's already fully ripened, the item already you can segregate from the land because it's no longer necessary to draw sustenance from the land because it's fully ripened, it's fully done. And almost along the lines of what Rabbi Shimon says in other places, kol omeid liktzor kikatzur dami. Everything that's already as if ready to be harvested is separated. So what Rashi seems to indicate is if it's not necessarily connected to the land anymore, not physically connected, but it doesn't need the land anymore, then that's already considered a shevach that can be detached. That shevach, the lokeach gets to keep. On the other hand, if it's shevach that's still dependent on the land, and the land is integral to the success of the shevach, then it's considered to be a part of the land, or part and parcel of the land, and the balchov can take the whole thing. The lokeach has no rights. That's what Rashi says. Tosfot, again, had played along with those lines and said that the Gemara in Tubot seems to say that. Things that need the land. But then Tosfot backs away from that and suggests that anything that eventually will be separated or segregated from the land. For instance, here he talks about unripened grapes or items that are not yet reached maturity, but the fact is that eventually they will reach maturity and you will pick them and they don't belong to the land. That is shevach that the lokeach can keep. Shevach, where he does something to the physical land, say he fertilized the land, and something that's not separable or eventually going to be separated from the land, that he won't get back. That the balchov can take, because that's part and parcel of the land itself. Any additional value added to the actual physical land, that the lokeach can't keep, the balchov can keep. Anything that is done, let's call it on top of the land, the shevach created on top of the land, there the Baalei Tosafot say that the lokeach can keep it because we can segregate or consider it separate from the land itself. So the grapevines, the vines, are not going to be separated from the land. But the grapes, as long as you have something that is a semblance of a grape, that will be separated from the land. Actually, that lokeach does have rights in. So that's how Tosafot segregates. Rabbeinu Tam Mefaresh, the shevach ha-magil ha-kvayim kamo davar haba betorach. Something that requires effort to create it. So things that are there on the land, then the lokeach has no rights to. Something that requires torach, continuous work on the item to produce it or to get it to its finished product that the lokeach has rights to. But they're all playing along a certain continuum of understanding what is considered to be the land and what is considered to be on the land or on top of the land. That which is part of the land or the land itself that the Baal Chov can take because that's what he's entitled to. That's what he can foreclose on. Anything that's above, something that's in excess or something that is not part and parcel of the land, that the lokeach has a right to. You're right, there is a certain amount of inequity here, but the lokeach bought into something that he knows about, and therefore he's got to make a decision about how he invests in that land. That's right.
Did the lokeach go back?
He does have a right, but in different ways. The land, he can go back to the creditor for the land that he can seize from even encumbered property. If he has buyers that were after him, the shevach he can only take from free and clear land. That's a takanat chachamim because of the problem that shevach has no limit. So buyers who come after him don't know how to assess the foreclosure tree or the lien tree because if they say, look, I know this guy bought, I know how much he owes, so this is what I think he's going to be exposed for, I can assess the risk. But what we don't know is if that guy starts investing in the land, there's no way to assess how much money they could come after him for. So that's why Chazal limited that type of thing. Ve'agmar says, v'ha'masim b'chol yom. Now, you made this distinction yet. On a regular basis, kamag ve'shvol afilu shevach ha'magia leketfayim. Even these items, which seemingly belong to lokeach, according to this distinction, for Rashi, that means it's something that's reached full maturity. According to Tosfot, something that eventually will be picked off the land, even though it's not at full maturity yet, or for the Rabbeinu Tam, something where you're investing work in it, you have to work in order to produce it, those things belong to the lokeach, yet Shmuel's handing that to the Baal Chov on a daily basis. Amarlei lokasha, ha'damasik be'kashir ara b'shibcha, ha'damasik be'alakashir ara. The difference is how much the creditor has outstanding here. Does the creditor have an amount that exceeds the value of the land? I mean, it's the land and the shevach, his loan or his foreclosure includes all of that. Versus a case where he only is entitled to the value of the land, meaning his loan does not reach the level of the shevach. So here, Shmuel seems to separate between if you're owed only the value of the land, then you can't keep the shevach just because it's a part of the land. You only have a right or your value is cashed out already at the point of the land, so your entitlement to the shevach is not there. On the other hand, in a case where your outstanding credit exceeds the value of the land, meaning so then you need the shevach too to get to the value that you're collecting, there you will be entitled to that. That would be the conclusion you have here. Tosfot already deals with two things. One is this only true by lokeach? Is this also true by yitomim? Before, we talked about in the Gemara two cases. It's a case of lokeach with shevach, and then we talk about yitomim that have shevach. Both times the creditor is coming after it. Is this din limited to a lokeach? And the reason being, what you asked before, is that the lokeach has recourse. He can go back after the person who sold him the land, the debtor who sold him the land. So since he has recourse, we'll say, fine, let the creditor take everything, and then he'll go with his recourse. He'll collect the land out of encumbered property of the debtor, meaning that even people who bought property after him, and the shevach he'll get from whatever free and clear property he has at this point. And that's why we'll let the creditor take everything. On the other hand, for the yitomim, they have nobody to go back on. Meaning that the reason they got the land is because it was their father's and they passed to them. If you allow the creditor to confiscate here, they have no recourse against anybody. There's nobody to go back to. So maybe you would think that's different. Tosafot says that he thinks that the din for yitomim is the same. That even though yitomim have no recourse against anyone, they still have the same din as a lokeach because they're viewed as kara davuim. They're seen as an extension of their father. And just like by the father, had the land been there and the shevach been on the land, the creditor could have gone after everything. So too by the yitomim, he can go after everything, even though that shevach technically is not belonging to the land or was not inherited from their father. But since it's an extension of the land, and had it been their father there, the creditor could have taken it. We allow him to take it from the yitomim as well, even though they have no recourse to get back that money or that shevach. Tosafot later on deals with the separate issue, which is, here you're talking about value created in the land, but value doesn't come in a vacuum. Value comes from an investment. There are yitziyot. There are costs to investing in the land to create that additional value. And now Tosafot discusses later on, he says here, V'hashtem matzino le'meimar, D'lukocho nami imasa putuki, yesh lo l'shalem lokeach ha'yitziyah. He has to pay the lokeach the costs that he invested in the land. Afilu mesik pei shir ara v'shavach v'shvacha. So now, what we talked about before, it seems inequitable that you should be able to take the shevach The answer to that is, we'll give you back your investment. So that answers your question, which is, yes, you invested money in the land. Usually you only invest money in the land if you get a return that exceeds the amount of money that you invested in the land. That's our assumption here, is that the shevach exceeds the value invested. So at that point, we say to the creditor when he takes it, look, we're going to give you the land and all of the appreciated value over here, the additional value that was created. But you still have to pay back the person who invested to make it worth more. You'll collect the additional value between the investment and the value created. So that you will get, even though technically somebody else made that investment, but you still have to pay them back for the investment. And that's what Tosfot says over here, that he thinks that you have to pay for the yitziyah. You do have to pay for the costs that were involved. And again, I'll come back to Tosfot in a second when the Gemara comes to conclusion. Gemara says, that works well according to the one who says that if the buyer has cash, that he can't force the Baal Chov to take cash instead of the land. Shapir, all of this works well because the creditor has the upper hand. The creditor can come and seize the property whether or not the lokeach likes it. Whether or not the lokeach is willing to hand him cash instead, the Baal Chov comes. And that's why he can also take the shevach, because the Baal Chov has the right of seizure here, irrespective of what the buyer wants to do. But according to the one who says that if the lokeach has cash, he can force the creditor to take cash. He says, listen, you're coming to seize the land. The land is worth this much. I'll give you the cash. I'll keep the land. You're after the cash. You're a creditor. You don't want land. You want the cash back that you lent out. I'll hand you the cash. Leave the land alone. Then, he says, had I had cash, I would have removed you from this land. Hashavli griva da'ara. You should now have to give me a section of the land, shur shvachai, the amount of my shevach that exists over here. Meaning that, in this case, lokeach really has the upper hand in terms of the land. He's really the owner of the land. And therefore, he can cash out the creditor's lien by handing him money. In that case, he is the priority owner of the land. And therefore, he could demand from the creditor, leave me a piece of land because that's what I own here, and I could have cashed you out. Had I had cash, I would have cashed you out entirely. Therefore, the shevach, leave me a piece of land for that shevach, because I'm the real owner of the land. The fact that you're seizing it is only because you have a right of seizure if you don't get cash. But since I could have cashed you out, I'm really entitled to this land, and I could demand a piece of the land. So the Gemara says, Ha'amar lei, ocha b'mayiskin, and what's the case here according to that daya? Go into Shabi Niele Aputuki. It's a case where it was a directed lien. In a case of a directed lien, then even according to the one who says that the lokeach, the buyer, has a upper hand and can cash out the creditor, but over here where it becomes a directed lien on this particular item, that already makes it that the creditor is the real owner, almost the default owner of this item. And since he's the default owner of this item, therefore we say that he can make the determination. I mean, he can cash out the lokeach. He can tell him you don't get any money, any karka for your shevach. This is mine. It's essentially mine from the beginning. You bought something with a directed lien on it. You took the risks that are associated with that. You're not going to be able to cash me out. I'm going to give you whatever I choose. I'll give you land. I'll give you cash. Whatever I choose, I give to you. You have no rights over here. So now on that, Tosfot goes on and says, Ulumaskana. Once we establish here that this was a directed lien, doesn't matter how much he's entitled to. Tosfot says that this conclusion of the Gemara eliminates the distinction we made before. The distinction we made before, whether the creditor has a outstanding loan that exceeds the value of the land, meaning that includes the shevach, or does not exceed, that will determine whether he gets the shevach or not. Tosfot says, according to this answer, we're done with that. That distinction doesn't exist anymore. What's the answer? Why is the creditor entitled to take the shevach over here? Because he has an aputuki. This was a directed lien. The kevin shaso aputuki mishalem yitziyah. He pays the cost. Afugav de mesik shur ara v'shevacha. Even if he owes him the land plus the shevach, he still has to pay for the cost. Miu yesh l'chalek. Says, maybe you can then make a distinction to the kuchot. Same distinction that Tosfot made before, maybe to distinguish between lokeach and a yatom, he says maybe now that distinction also will affect the lokeach. The fact that the lokeach has recourse, maybe he's not entitled to the costs that he invested in the land, because he can always go back to the debtor and ask him for that money. Now, probably the debtor doesn't have the money. That's why the creditor is coming after him. But still, he has recourse against someone to get that money back. Maybe in that case, the creditor does not have to pay him for the cost. And he can say, listen, that's your problem. You deal with that with the debtor. As far as I'm concerned, I'm taking everything that's here. So Tosafot gives two possibilities based on the conclusion of the Gemara as to what the creditor's rights are here. Is the creditor's rights to take the land plus the shevach, everything, and he has no obligations towards the buyer whatsoever, and the buyer's investment, go after the debtor for that. You should go after the person you bought the karka from. That's not my problem. Or do we say that even though he's entitled to the land plus the shevach because his credit extension is greater than that value, nevertheless, he has to pay the lokeach for his investment, because the fact that he made the investment is something that he wasn't entitled to. He's entitled to land and whatever value exists on the land now, but somebody invested money, that he has to pay out to the lokeach. So Tosfot is uncertain as to which way it should go, whether it does go to the lokeach, whether he pays the lokeach for that, or he says to him, too bad, you go after the debtor who sold you the property. Then for the yitomim, there it would seem like for sure he has to pay them the yitziah, because the yitomim have nobody to go after to get their money back for their investment. So for there it would seem like Tosfot says for sure that the creditor would have to pay them for the value that they created. Amar Rava. So now you have a little small thing here by Rava. It says, Gazal vishbiach. He steals it. He improves the land. Umachar. And then he sold it. Vigazal. Or he stole the land. Vishbiach. And improved the land. Vihorish. And then he died, passed away, and it was given as Yerusha. Mashish biach machar. Umashish biach horish. Whatever he improved on the land, he sold. Whatever he put on the land is now belongs to the Yorshim. What Rava is speaking about is unclear. And what is the Chiddush of Rava? So if you look in Rashi, Rashi says, Mashish biach machar, says, Vishakil lokeach mekza oshlish oravia v'chein yoresh. The same way that the gazlan is entitled to the percentage of the outcome over here, meaning that we look at him as the active partner in a partnership, where the nigzal is the silent partner, the gazlan is the active partner, and therefore he takes a percentage of the property, according to Rabbi Shimon. Or, according to Rabbi Yehuda, he gets the whole shevach, the gazlan gets the whole shevach. Then, that's because of takanat ha-shavim, meaning that either according to Rabbi Yehuda min ha-din, or according to our Mishnah, because of takanat ha-shavim, where you get all the shevach, then the party that he sold it to also gets that entitlement. Meaning that the buyer from him gets that same right, or the yoresh, his inheritor, gets that same right. We don't say that this is unique or particular to the gazlan himself, and say that just because of the gazlan, we're going to allow him these rights, because we don't want him to not do tshuva, or we don't want him to lose out in order that then he's disincentivized. But over here, when the people who bought it from him, or the people who are yoresh from him, they don't have that consideration, maybe over there the shevach should go back to the nigzal. The answer is no, that the yoresh, or the buyer, gets the same entitlement that the gazlan had over here. And the reason being, Rava is going to say in a second, which is kol zchut that the gazlan had, he sold to that other party. Kol zchut that the gazlan had, he gave, or he's yoresh, to the other party. So whatever rights he has are now being passed to this next party, and they can make the same claim that the gazlan could have made. Now over here, the question is, how does this reconcile with other places? And you're going to see here, Tosafot gives one answer, and the Grug gives a different answer, and that helps us to understand what Rava, or the case Rava, is speaking about. Tosafot over here says, Afagal de per kamen de bov metziah mashma, defil rav damar yesh lo shevach, bishalo hikir ba, sheinu shalo, vilakha, hainu mi gazlan. Aval nigzal lo yayiv shevach. That's only true when we're talking about the gazlan. When we're talking about the nigzal doesn't have to give any shevach to the buyer. So he says, hainu bekarka she'ena nigzalet. That's only in a case when we're talking about land that can't be stolen. Gazlan gufei le shevach. Because there the gazlan himself doesn't entitle to the shevach, because the land always remains with the original nigzal. Aval hocha b'metaltalin she'e shevach le gazlan. Over here, we're talking about metalkalin that the gazlan invested in or did something to in order to make them worth more. Mipnei takanat ha-shavim. Gam lo lokeach menu yeshlo. So Tosfot makes a distinction over here, which is important to the case or understanding of all of this. Tosfot over here says, Rova's din is a case by metalkalin. The dinim where we say that there's no entitlement of shevach, those are cases of karka. So cases of karka where he's hishbiach the karka, there the gazlan is not entitled to anything because the karka ain't a nigzelet. Karka is never stolen. By definition, karka is not stolen because karka can't be moved. Now, you can't technically, quote unquote, steal karka by utilizing someone else's property. But in the end, the bottom line is that you're unable to steal the karka because the karka always remains. It's fixed in place. It's just a question of whose title or whose ownership we're speaking about. So since you could never really steal the karka, it always remains with the original owners. Therefore, the gazlan has no entitlement to the shevach or no entitlement to anything here. And so therefore, just like he has no entitlement, so too the buyer has no entitlement to anything here as well. That's the other cases where there's no shevach. Cases where there is shevach, so bintalklin, where he can't actually steal it. We actually can take possession of it. Over there, because of takanat shavim, we said that the gazlan gets some sort of shevach, whether that's the whole shevach or a percentage of the shevach, so too the buyer is entitled to that. That's how Tosfot deals with Rava's scenario, and he's telling you Rava's scenario is a scenario of metaltalin. If you look in the Gra in Ot Aleph comments and says, Devenir Beinai, Verith Teretz, the shame Shvacha de Memela, Vekan Machmat Hotza'a. The Rif draws a different distinction here in Rava, and says it depends how the appreciation comes about. If the appreciation is Memela, which is that it happens by itself, there was no investment made by the gazlan, that type of shevach goes back to the baalim. Because over there, there's no disincentive to the gazlan to return the property. He didn't do anything to the property that made it worth more. It was worth more either because prices went up, which everybody agrees that the gazlan has no entitlement to, because it's simply a market vagrity, which he didn't do anything with. But even if it's something that happened to the land, things grew on the land while he owned it, but he did nothing to do that. Some seed fell there in a tree or some vine started to grow. If he did nothing to the land in order to increase its value, but it did increase in value because of that, then that shevach goes back to the baalim. That the person has no entitlement. Rava, the case that he's speaking about here is a case where he invested in the land. The gazlan invested in the land. That's where you're going to have a disincentive for the gazlan to give it back if he can't get his money back out of it. And that's where the takanat shavim kicks in and says either he gets a percentage of the profits or he gets the whole thing and keeps the whole shevach in order to incentivize him to give it back. Because otherwise, he won't give it back. He says, I put in money here. If I have to give it all back with all that money that I put into it, there's no way I'm going to do that. Not only am I going to lose what I stole, I'm going to lose additional money on top of that. I'm going to be penalized. And that's going to be a huge disincentive to doing tshuva. So there the Rif makes that distinction in our Gemara over here, that Rava's statement is about a case of investment, where he's out money in the property to get that value. Tosfot says it's a case of metaltalin. What you can see both of them trying to do is figure out or reconcile Rava with other scenarios where the shevach does not stay with the gazlan and does not go to the lokeach. How do we deal with that? And so you have to make some sort of distinction, and that's what they're doing here in explaining this shita of Rava. So by Rava, hishbiach lokeach mahu. Now, we spoke about cases where the gazlan was the one who invested, and then it was sold, or the gazlan invested, and then it was inherited. But what happens in a case where it goes to the lokeach, and then the lokeach is the investor? So the shevach was created by the lokeach. Bata de baye hired their pashta. After he asked the question, he answered it. Mama harishon l'sheni, kol zchut shetavo liyado. That what did he sell to the other party? Any rights that he has. When the gazlan sends it to the lokeach, the gazlan himself, if he invested in the property and put shevach into the property, he would keep the shevach that we just saw from the previous statement of Rava. Therefore, he grants that right to whomever he sells it to. When you sell something, we say that you sell all of your rights in the property. All of those rights include the ownership rights, as well as other legal claims that you might have. And over here, the gazlan has certain legal claims because of his status as a gazlan. And therefore, when he sells it to the other party, he sells it with those legal rights as well. So just like the gazlan himself could make a claim against the shevach because of takanat shavim, that right is sold to the lokeach, and the lokeach gets to make the same claim and keep, whether it's the whole amount for takanat shavim, or he keeps a percentage of the amount because he bought whatever the gazlan was thinking. Now again, as Rashi says over here, the havamina would be that you wouldn't have to do that, that you don't get anything because it's because of takanat shavim. Takanat shavim is not relevant to the lokeach, to the buyer. So the answer is that the gazlan sold him those rights, and then he gets to make the same claim the gazlan would have made, and lokeach gets to keep those rights. That's the chiddush of Rava, that the lokeach gets to keep the rights of the gazlan, even though he's not a gazlan, or he's not really subject to takanat shavim. So now the next, by Rava, his biach oved kochavim mahu. What if it was an oved kochavim that invested in it? What's the outcome? So Amar le Rav Acha midifta Ravina, takanta lo vedei kochavim niko v'ne'avad. It doesn't make sense. In the letter of the law, there is no entitlement of the gazlan to anything that's here. The only reason we do it is because takanat shavim. We want them to do tshuva. So that's true when you're talking about a Jew, because he is a part of the system. And within the system, we want to encourage him to do tshuva. So therefore, takanat shavim is relevant. Or there's a reason to incentivize him to do tshuva. On the case of an oved kochavim, why should we give him those additional benefits? I mean, these really are benefits to the gazlan or to the lokeach. Why should the oved kochavim be entitled to those rights? So Amar Lei, he says to him, lo, tzricha kagon de zavnei l'Yisrael. He sold it to Israel. So what happened here was you have a Jew's property that's stolen by an oved kochavim, and then the oved kochavim sells it to a Jew, and the Jew is the investor. So sof sof, haba machmad oved kochavim, harei oved kochavim. What's the question over here? The only reason we said in the previous case that the lokeach had any rights is because the gazlan had rights. He bought the rights from the gazlan. That means when he's a Jewish gazlan, he has those rights. And when he sold it to lokeach, the lokeach inherited those rights or bought those rights from him. But if the thief was an oved kochavim and then he sells it to a Jew, the Jew gets the same rights the oved kochavim had. And those rights are no rights because they're incentivizing him to do tshuva. There's no reason to incentivize him. So when it says lo tzricha kagon the gazal Yisrael v'zavna ni'alei v'ishbicha oved kochavim v'adar oved kochavim zavna ni'Yisrael. So the case here is where it was stolen by a Jew, sold it to an oved kochavim, the oved kochavim improved the property, and then a Jew bought it off of him in the end. So now you have a Jew at the end, meaning the final lokeach is a Jew, the gazlan is a Jew, but in between it passed through the hands of an oved kochavim. My, mi amarin and came to me kar Yisrael v'hadar Israel. So now, since it was originally a Jew, and now it ends back up in the hands of a Jew, Israel, therefore, Avdei Rabbanon Takanto, the Rabbanon put in the institution to help him out. Odilma came to Iko V'Kochavim Be'emtza, lo Avdei Rabbanon Takanto. Or maybe because the Ovi Kochavim in the middle, they basically said, okay, that's the end of the Takana. The Ovi Kochavim is not entitled to that Takana. Therefore, the Takana ends there. Teiku. That we leave as unresolved. Okay, next. Amar Papa. Haiman the Gazel Dikla Mechabre. Person who steals a palm tree from his friend. Vikatle. And he killed it. Killing it, obviously doesn't mean that you kill it. Rashi says, cuts it so. He cut it down. That the equivalent of killing a tree is to cut the tree down. So he cut the tree down. And now, Afagav Deshadya Mi Ara La Ara Dide. Even though if he moved it from the original owner's property to his property, nevertheless, Lokani, he's not kone. My taima, mikara dikla mikre, v'hashtanami dikla mikre. When it was in the ground, it was called a palm tree. When it's out of the ground, or when you carry it over to your land, it's still called a palm tree. Now, truthfully, usually shinei reshut should be enough to create a kinyan, but that's only when you have yeush and then shinei reshut. So what the rishonim indicate over here is this is before yeush. Since it's before yeush, you can't have shinei reshut be the kinyan. You need something that is shinoi maise, or a real shinoi in the object itself, in order to generate a kinyan. And what the Gemara is saying over here is the moving of the dekel from this location, after it's been cut down, to your location, is not considered any change. It was called a dekel, it was called a palm tree while it was on the original owner's land. And when it's on your land now, it's called a palm tree, even though it's severed or it's cut. It's called a palm tree. Therefore, it's the same item. There's no shinoi over here. There is no kinyan. Now, Tosafot asks on that, wait a minute. If you kill a behema, if you kill an animal, that is called a shinoi. So why isn't killing or cutting a tree down also called a shinoi? So Tosafot says, because there's a big difference. By an animal, he says, have a shinoi de minkar tfei. It's obvious when an animal is alive versus when an animal is dead. That's very clear. A palm tree, if it was attached to this guy's land, and then he cut it and he stuck it down on his land, it's not necessarily obvious that the tree is not still alive or planted there. It's not clear that it's not a palm tree anymore. That's the way that Balei HaTosafot deal with it. There are others, like I think the Tosafot, Rabbeinu Peretz over here, who suggest that the palm tree was already dead. Meaning that it was still rooted in the ground, but it was dead on the original owner's land. So when you cut it down now and take it over to your land, you really haven't changed anything. So that would be a little more, I'd say, palatable than what Tosafot is describing. Tosafot is describing a live tree that is planted in the ground, you sever it, take it over to your land, it's still called a palm tree, therefore there's no shinoi over here. Different than killing a behemoth. Okay, you're right, killing a behemoth is much more extreme, but cutting a tree down, you can tell when a tree is in the ground and when a tree is severed, or even if you put any other piece in the ground, maybe it's not as obvious, but it seems like that's enough of a change. So therefore, the Tosafot Rabbeinu Peretz suggests that the tree was dead from the start. So it was only the katzeitz in a sense. It was ready to be cut down because it was a dead tree already. At that point, if he severs the tree, takes it over, it's still called, there was a palm tree here, a palm tree there. No difference, and therefore there's no shinoi over here for a kinyan. Dikla, if it was originally a palm tree, ve'aved govei, and he makes it into logs, lo kani. Once again, he's not kone. Hashta mia govei de dikla mikre. Because they're called palm logs. So in essence, if you take the tree and cut it into sections, those sections are still called palm tree logs. They're not just called wood. They still carry the name of the palm tree on it. And once again, it's not considered to be a change or a shinoi enough to give you a kinyan in the item. That's what Rashi describes over here. Gove, he says, are trinkas, or from the word trunk, like trunks. They are sections of the trunk. That's not enough, again, to change the name. Govi, vabdinu kishure, the other hand, if he takes the logs and he makes them into beams, kani, that's a kinyan. Because beams no longer have the original name associated with them. They're no longer called palm beams. They are called beams. And since they're called beams, that's already a real shinoi in the item. And that's enough to generate a kinyan. Kshure rabrave, vabdinu kshure zutre. He has large beams and he makes them into smaller beams. Lo kani. Over there he's not kone them. Avdinu kutsutsaita. He makes them into boards. Kani. Then he already is kone it because that is a change again. You're changing it from being a kshure, which are beams, into boards. So again, if you make big beams and smaller beams, they're still called beams and therefore there's no shinoi over here. You take a beam and make it into a board, make it something significantly smaller than it was before, that already changes the name of it, and that's considered to be a kinyan. Amarova, haiman de gozo luliva, vabdina nhutse. Someone who steals a palm branch, and then he makes it into hutse, into leaves, then he's kone, demikara luluve mikre, because originally they were called, we call them palm branches or palm leaves. Vashte hutse. And now they are considered to be hutse, which are separated or... So if you think about the lulav, after you take your lulav, after Sukkot, sometimes you make them, you peel the leaves off the lulav, and then you use those leaves for weaving or doing something with them. While they're attached to the shidra, it was still called a lulav, it's still called a palm branch. Once you peel the leaves off of the shidra from the center spine, you don't call it a lulav anymore. There you call them leaves or you call them hutse. So that's the difference here. Once you've done that, that's enough of a shinoi to be classified as a kinyan. So because of where it says, the mikar lulavi mikrai, originally was a lulav, ashta hutse, now they're called leaves, so now they're called something separate. Hutse vavdina nchufya, if he takes the leaves of the palm, ties them together, and makes it into a broom, basically. It's the equivalent of a broom. You take these palm leaves that are already separated from the shidra, you bind them together, and now you have a broom or some sweeper to use it. Kani, against you are kone. Mikara hutse, originally they were these leaves. Hashta chufya, now it's a broom. Chufya va'avde shorshura. On that end, if you take the broom and then you make it into a rope, lo kani. There is not kone. Maitaima. Because all you have to do is untie it, and then it'll go back to being the broom that it was before. If the tiyomet splits, mahu, what is the din? Now, the tiyomet has halakhic ramifications for the kashrut of a lulav, and what the Gemara seems to be doing over here is equating between the halakha of the kashrut of a lulav and a shinoi. I mean, if it's a kosher lulav, and whatever happens here would make it into lulav pasul, that's enough of a shinoi that would be deemed a kinyan. That's the Gemara's assumption over here, that not only is a change, physical change, enough to generate a kinyan, a halachic change would also be significant enough to deem it to be a shinoi for a kinyan. So over here, where he starts out with a kosher lulav, and ends up with a pasul lulav, that would be enough to generate a kinyan. So what is nechakat tiyomet? Rashi over here claims, kaf tomer haemtzai, helyon tiyometu. The middle leaf that sits above all the other leaves, that is the tiyomet. So that's what Rashi says over here, and implications from Rashi, as Tosva notes over here, is that if that leaf, that middle leaf split, then that would make the lulav not kosher. Tosva says, if that's the case, we've never seen a kosher lulav in our lives. That's what Tosfot says. Now remember, the Bali of Tosfot are not living anywhere near where there are palm trees. They have to get palm trees from far away. But what Tosfot is saying is they have never seen a case where the tiyomet, that middle leaf, is completely sealed up. So therefore, the Tosfot says something over here, which Rashi himself says in Masechet Sukkah. Rashi has a much more explicit and more lengthy description of what a tiyomet is over there, that is somewhat similar to what Tosfot says over here. Tosfot says, Matzari b'tshuvat agonim, that what is the tiyomet? Oto hutza elyon, b'rosh lulav, that leaf fits at the top, she'en hutza l'mala imenu, where there's no taller leaf than it, v'hu k'shnei hutzim dvukim zeh bezeh. And it's as if it's got two leaves that are attached together. That's the tiyomet. The middle piece that extends out of the spine and is the tallest leaf of the palm branch, that leaf goes all the way up to the top, has basically two leaves that are attached together all the way to the top. And also the Bahag sounds like that's what the tiyomet is. Uli divrehem lo yimatzeh lanu lulav kasher. Says, we will never see a kosher lulav. Ki betorach nimtzim otam sheyesh lehem tiyomet kazeh. There's no, we never find a tiyomet like this. Afilu echad mehemeot. 1 out of 500. I mean, he's talking about percentages that are so low that there is no such lulav like this. V'yesh lomar she'afti divrehem. Even according to their saying, ain't pasul, el shaya mitchila kinyan zeh, benechlak, benishtane bibriato. So Tosfot gives the first answer, which is, nechlaka tiyomet is only a problem if it was originally sealed, and then it split. So that would be a problem. But if it grew split, that would not be a problem. So that's Tosfot's first solution to the problem, is to say that they're talking about if it grew that way, and then it changed. But if it was always that way, maybe it would not be kosher. But then, he gives a second answer, which is ubekuches perish nechlegu atiyomet shnei alim elyonim etzaim shesham kala shidra nechlegu mizem mizem nistaka shidra adalim shalmata mehen. Here Tosfot quotes Rashi and Sukkah, which is that yes, the tiyomet is those middle two leaves that go up to be the high point. Yes, they are split, but they have to be split so far as to reach the leaves below them, meaning that the shidra is the spine of the lulav, and out of the spine come all the leaves. The middle two leaves also extend out of the top of the spine. They would have to be split enough that they reach down to the point where the other leaves are there. Or basically you're splitting into the spine to where the leaves below them extend from the spine. So that would be a much more significant type of split. And then he says, mitok perishu masha shenis daka shidra kolkach shenira elyonim chalukim ufruzim zeh bezeh, that the split is so great that the upper two leaves look split from each other. That already tells what says we do find, that we find most of our lulavim don't have that problem, and therefore they would be lulavim miksherim. Then tells what says, v'odomeri deyesh mifashim shekol alei alulav kfulim kol echad deshnayim. This is also true, that if you peel off the leaves of the lulav, then you can actually separate them into two leaves. Each leaf is actually a double leaf. And the one that's in the middle is the tiyomet. He says, Miu, in rova lulavim nitzim ki in yazeh. He says, most of them don't look like that. But a piece of the shidra was also cut. So here the Ri explains, maybe we're talking about that middle leaf is not the two leaves together, but the one leaf that's the tallest leaf, if that is actually split, like every other leaf in the lulav that's a double, that double leaf is split. But Tosfot again says that doesn't seem like the case, because most of the lulavim don't have that type of situation or circumstance. So therefore, they favor the Rashi's explanation in Sukkah, in order then to explain, like the Gonim, that a tiyomet is the middle two leaves that extend above the rest, and that they have to be tightly together. And Rashi says in order to be pasul, it has to reach down to the Shidra. Many Rishonim believe it has to be Rove, meaning that the Rove of the area between the base of where they extend from the spine until the Tabut Yom, it has to be split in order for it to be pasul. And therefore, we're makbid that it shouldn't be split at all, because therefore, if it is split at all, once it begins to split, it easily splits further down. So we're makbid that it shouldn't be split at all, because of the fact that it could split further. But it seems from this that either a rove, according to most of Rishonim, according to Rashi, has to even get into the Shidra in order for it to be a problem. Question is, nechal tiyomet mau? So tashma, da rabbi matonam rabbi Yoshua ben Levi, nitla tiyomet, if the tiyomet is missing, pasul, the lulav is pasul. My lav, hu adin la nechlaka, just like if it was missing its pasul, so to it split is pasul. My says, lo, nitla shiny da chasule. That's a different story. When it's missing it, that's a chasur. That's much more of a significant item. And that's why it's pasul over there. But that doesn't tell you anything about nechlaka tiyomet. Ikadamre tashma, damre relaton, amre bishum and levi. This was the memra. Nechlaka tiyomet, nase kamishinat lo pasul, shmamina. So from here, that's what we held, alocha, is that the tiyomet is split, it's as if it's missing. It's as if it's gone, and it is pasul. Shmamina from here, since it's pasul for the lulav, that is enough of a change in the lulav that it would be a kinyan for dine mimonot. And that's what the Gemara concludes over here. Amar papa, hai man de guzzle afro, someone who steals dirt from his friend, va'avde levinta, and he makes them into bricks, he makes them into mud bricks, lo kani, he's not kone them. My daima, what's the reason? The hada mishavale afra. He says, because you can make them back into dirt. Meaning that once, when you've made mud bricks can return to mud after they're made into mud bricks. So the shino you made is not something that is not chuzer the briato. It's something that goes back to its original state. Levinta v'avde afra koni. Now then, if he steals a brick, a mud brick, and then he crushes it down to being dirt, that he would be considered a kinyan. That is a shinoi. Why? My amart. Dilma hodr v'avid levinta. What are you going to do? You're just going to make it back into a mud brick. Ha levinta achritahu. That's a new brick. Upanim chadashot ba'ulukan. Talking about a new item. The way Rashi describes it over here, you're never going to get the exact dirt that was crushed from the original brick. You're not going to get all of that dirt back into the new brick. Or a different way to formulate it is simply that every brick is unique. Every mud brick is unique. No matter, even if you use the exact same raw materials, each one of them is unique. And therefore, if you crush it and then put it back together, you haven't created the same brick that you destroyed originally. Well, the Rashba asks your question and says that, wait a minute, if you take mud and make it into a mud brick and then you crush it again, you don't exactly have what you had before, or it doesn't really return to its original state. So the Rashba over here, because of that, says it has to be a case where it wasn't fired yet. It's a mud brick that dried out, but wasn't put into a kiln in order to fire it. He says, if you fire it in the kiln, it changes the dynamic or the properties of the mud, and it won't return to its original state. If you simply make it into a mud brick and dry it out, then it's no different. It's just mud caked together, and you can undo that, and that can be unwound. So the Rashba, trying to address your issue, says that this is a case where it wasn't fired. Right now, next case is, Vamara Papa, Haiman de Guzzle Naska, someone who steals unformed metals. We're usually talking about silver, gold, those types of unformed metals. Mechabrei from his friend, Ba'aved Zuzei. And he coined them. He minted them into coins. Lokani. Again, he's not koneh. My time. Other Aved Lohu, Nascha. It's very easy to return a coin to its previous state. I mean, you could take a coin, melt it back down, and you have unformed silver, unformed gold now. Nothing has changed. Tosfot mentions, Dafka Avde Zuzei. Avalasamin and Nascha Kli. If you made it into a utensil, then koni. Avagal Dehadar Aved Le Nascha. Even though you could melt it back to the original metal, to lo gorem nisarim vasan kelim. That's no different than boards that you make into a kli. About zuzei v'levena ain't torat chashivut alehem. They're not significant enough of a change to be considered a kinyan. So Tosfot says that it's not just simply that something happened over here. You have to have a happening or some change that has significance that either gains it a new name or it's noticeable. It has to be something of really significant quality. The other Rishonim will argue on that Tosfot and say that even if you take the metal and make it into a kli, since you can melt it back down again, it's still considered to be no shinoi. But Tosfot at least makes the distinction between what we'll call significant change and a small change or a small creation that you have over here. Small creations are not enough of a change. A big creation, even though it can be returned to its original state, is considered to be a kinyan because it's so significant what you did. Zuzei v'abdinu nascha. The other hand, if he steals a coin, and then makes it into unformed metal. He melts the coin down. Kani, there he is Konet. Maya Martz, what are you going to say again? Hoder Avidu Zuzay. He'll reform them, he'll re-mint them into new coins. Again, Panim Chadashot, Baudukan. The coin that you're making now is not the same coin that you destroyed before. Even though you can replicate this scenario, replicate the coin, it is a new coin, and that new coin you will not have a kinyan on. That new coin is not a continuation of the old coin, and therefore, it'll never be the same coin it was before, and there is a kinyan here when you take it from being a coin down to unformed metal. Shchime, Vavdinu Chadate. If you have, probably here we're talking about either tin or silver that's tarnished. And now you remove the tarnish. You polished it in a way and you remove the tarnish from it. Lo kani. There's no kinyan because it can always return to its tarnished state. Silver that's polished returns to its tarnished state. No problem. It just needs to be oxidized again. And that silver sulfide then makes the tarnish come back. Chadatei vavdinu shchime. Now then, if you have polished or clean silver that becomes tarnished, meaning that you tarnish it, then kani, you are kone. Mayamart, hadar avidu chadatei. You can polish it again and make it back to its original state. Mia, mida yedia shchimayu. You can always tell something that was once tarnished. In that when you polish an item that was tarnished, you never get it back to its original pure silver state. There's always some residual tarnish or something in there that makes it not as pure as it originally was. So therefore, if you steal clean silver and then you tarnish it, that already is a change that's irreversible because you'll never get it back to its original state. On the other hand, if you steal something that's tarnished and polish it, and it goes back being tarnished, when something's tarnished, there you don't have that type of fine distinction. If it was tarnished before, tarnished now, it looks like it did before. It's the same item it was before. If you look on the side here, the Mishpat brings down from the Rosh the possibility that the other girsa here is Panim Chadashu Balukan. That the answer here is the same thing as it was before. When you talk about silver that then was tarnished and then you're repolishing it, he calls that Panim Chadashu Balukan. The Argamar does not have that girsa. Argamar has that. It still has residuals or residue of the tarnish and therefore you never get it back to its original state. The Rosh is claiming it's Panim Chadashu Balukan. When you clean it off and you take off the tarnish, you're now bringing a new silver to the face here, and that's not the original silver that was there, partly because it does wear down a little bit, or when you're deoxidizing the silver to take away the sulfur, that also takes a piece of the silver, it affects the silver itself, so maybe you can claim that that is panim chadashot ba'udekan. Right now, the Gemara goes back to the Mishnah's principle, zeklau, kol ha-gazanim mishalmim kishad ha-gzela. All thieves pay at the time of the gzela. It says that tuye mai. What does that come to include? Tuye had amar Rabbi Elazar ganav tle menaseayu. He steals something that is a sheep, or we'll call it a lamb. Menaseayu, and then it becomes a ram. So it aged. Now it's grown older. Egel, a calf. Menase shor. Now it's become an ox. Nase shinoi biado. That is considered to be a shinoi. Vikanao, and he acquires it. Tabachu machar. After that point in time, he shechs it or sells it. Shalohu mutoveach, shalohu mocher. He's selling his own item. He's shechting his own item. He's not going to pay dalid behe because this is a kinyan. Hal gavro de gazal padna de tore mechavre. This individual stole, I call him a pair of oxen. But they're more than a pair of oxen. They're under the same yoke. They basically work together. Steals a pair of oxen. Azal kravbahu kravva. He goes out and he plowed his field with them. Zarabu Zara, then he used them to seed the field. The Sof Adrino, the Mare, and then he returns them to its owner. It's a nice guy, he basically borrowed them without asking. He utilized them and then gave them back to their original owner. Ata the Gemeder of Nachman, Amalu, Zilu Shumu Shvacha de Ashba. Go and assess how much value he gained. Basically, he used these Shvarim during that time, he would have had to rent them. How much rental income was foregone by this guy stealing them and utilizing them in this way? Because he didn't pay for that. He should have paid for it. Let's figure out how much value was created by these oxen, and he should have to pay that to the original owner. Amalei Rava, Torei Ashbach, Arei Lo Ashbach. Wait a minute. The Shvarim were the only contributor to the value enhancement here in the land. The value enhancement in the land was done both by the Shvarim's contribution as well as the land's contribution. When we say you seed something and then it grows, the fact that you seed it and it grows is not just because they plowed the field, not just because they helped to seed the field, but rather it has to do with the mix. It's both the contribution of the Shvarim as well as the natural nutrients of the land and the land itself. So how can you say here, go assess the additional value created in the land and then charge that to this guy because that's the value that he created by taking the Ishvarim? He says, I didn't say to assess the whole value and then charge him the whole value. I said assess the value and charge him for 50% of the value, because we'll assume that the Shvarim were 50% of the contribution and the land was 50% of the contribution. Says, in the end, it's the theft. And he's handing him back the original item. They paid based on the time of the theft. So why does he gain any value? If he got it, if he owned it from the time of the theft, then why is any of the value that's created after that point in time accrue to the original owner? The original has no rights over here. So he chastises Rava and he says, why are you challenging me while I'm in the middle of a case? So Rava is asking these questions while he's trying to adjudicate this case and penalize this individual, and Rava is challenging him. And he says to them, it's not appropriate that you're challenging me during the din. Damar Huna Chabrin, Eli, because Huna, our friend, says about me, Ana v'shavur Malka achai bedina. I and Shavur the Malka are like brothers in the din. So now, what he means, it's not clear here. Rashi over here says that Shavur Malka refers to Shmuel. That actually a machloket and all over Shas. When the Gemara uses the term Shavur Malka, is it referring to Shmuel or is it referring to the Persian king Shavur Malka? Shavur Malka is the equivalent of Paro of Imelech. It was a name adopted by the Sassanid dynasty in Persia. And Shavur Malka was the name that was adopted by many of those kings. So now Shavur Malka was the king of Persia and Shmuel was nicknamed Shavur Malka. The reason being either because Shmuel was very close with Shavur Malka, they had a very good relationship, and that might be the reason. Or the other reason is that, Rashi quotes this in other places in Shas, is that Shmuel's halachot were like Shavur Malka. Just like when the king says something, it goes. When Shmuel says in Midin, it goes, because Shmuel is like Shavur Malka. That's the way that they compare it. So over here, it's not clear. When it says here that Rav Huna says about Rav Nachman that he's like Shavur Malka, does that mean he's like Shmuel? That's what Rashi says over here, because Shmuel was nicknamed Shavur Malka. And just like by Shmuel, the halacha is like Shmuel, so too the halacha is like Rav Nachman. Or is he saying literally that Rav Nachman is like Shavur Malka, the Persian king? Just like the Persian king, when he sets down a law, that's the law. So too when Rav Nachman sets down the law, that's the law. And that's the principle we have by Rav Nachman, that halacha Rav Nachman bedine. The halacha is like Rav Nachman dinim, because Rav Nachman was a judge, and a preeminent judge, and therefore the halachot are like him because he has tremendous experience in the case law, as well as his erudition in the oral tradition. And so for that reason, the halachot is like Rav Nachman. So Rav Nachman is chastising his Talmid Rava and saying, listen, it's enough. Don't ask me during the case. I have reasons for what I'm doing. And he explains to him the reason now. Why is he penalizing this guy when our Mishnah says that a Gazlan acquires it and it's over at that point in time? He doesn't owe him anything for the utilization of it after that point in time. The answer he says is, Hai inish gazlana atikahu. This guy is a well-seasoned thief. Ubeina the ikanase. And I have to penalize him. In order to stop him over here, if we don't penalize him, if I don't give him a penalty or fine him, he's not gonna stop. What is he doing? He's stealing people's animals, utilizing them, saying I'm a gazlan. So I acquire it then, hands the animal back, he's patur. And meantime, he's getting the usage out of the animals in between. So that works well if you're talking about one-time gazlan. When you're talking about a recurring offender, he's taking advantage of the system. So I'm going to do an extrajudicial psak here, which is I'm going to penalize him, even though that's not the halacha, because I got to stop him. If I don't penalize him, he's just going to keep doing this over and over again. So that's what he says to Rava. Rava, don't challenge me while I'm in the middle of the din, because I have my reasons. And he explains to him the reasons why he did it. But in the end, the answer is yes. The halacha is, like Rava said, which is that the gazlan is acquiring it. And not only is the gazlan acquired, but even in a change in the physical standing of the animal, I mean, it's grown up. That's enough of a change in order to acquire it. The next Mishnah. Gazal beima v'izkina, avadim v'izkinu. Steals an animal and it got older. Avadim, slaves and they got older. Mishalem kashat ha-gzela. He pays like the time of the gzela, because we assume here that that change in the item is a kinyan. The fact that they aged is a kinyan, and therefore he pays based on the shat ha-gzela, not on their current. He can't just hand the animal back anymore. He can't hand the ibid back. By Avadim, you can hand him back and say, Ari Shalcha Lefanecha. The reason being is that Avadim are who kush the karkaot. Eved Kanani is the same thing as Karka. And just like Karka is in an exelet, so too a Eved Kanani is in an exelet. Now that's an interesting question, and again is a subject to many machlokot in the Rishonim, as well as in the Gemara itself, is to what the status of an Eved Kanani is. When we say an Eved Kanani is kick Karka, how far do you take that? How far do you say he's like Karka? Is he just like Karka because he's a possession, and he can be traded and sold and bought and inherited like Karka? Or when you say like he's Karka, he's literally like Karka. And just like you don't take a Shavua on Karka, you don't take a Shavua on an Eved. Just like you don't have Kefel by Karka, you also don't have Kefel by an Eved Kanani. And just like you don't have Gezel by Karka, you don't have Gezel by an Eved Kanani. Or you say the reason you don't have Gezel by Karka is because Karka doesn't move. But an Eved Kanani that can't be moved, maybe there is Gezel. So Rabbi Meir over here says he is like Karka. If he's like Karka, he's in an exelet. In an exelet, there's no Kinyan. And therefore, you can hand him back the evidence. They are Shelchal Lefanecha. He's returning the original item because there was no Kinyan in between. Gezel went Be'ab and he's duck. He stole a coin and then it cracked. Peirot v'yerkivu, fruit, and then it rotted. Yayin v'chmitz, wine, and then it fermented. It became vinegar. V'shalem k'shat ha'gzeilah. All of those are considered to be a shinoi. And he pays, like, based on the time of the gzeilah. But peyam v'nifsal. On the other hand, it's a coin, but that went out of circulation. Truma v'nitmeit. Truma, and then it became tmeah. Chameitz v'avala v'pesach. Chameitz and Pesach passed by. Be'ima v'nit'avdal bo v'avera. A behema that an avera was done with it, either bestiality or avodah zarah, where there's one aid. And therefore, the animal no longer is ra'ui to go on the mizbeach. Or, if there are two aidim, it's going to be subject to a death penalty. Osha nifsala mi'agabe mizbeach. Pasul from going on the mizbeach. Over here, Rashi claims that it's a dokin shiba'ayin. It's a type of mum in the animal which exists, but isn't so obvious or visible, not the type of it. Mum that stands out, but it's a mum that won't allow it to go on the Mizbeach. Tosafot, in the Gemara, when the Gemara discusses this, differentiates between a mum that happened in Mela versus a mum that was done by the person. If a mum was inflicted on the animal by the Gazlan, that is a Shinoi. If it's a wound that happened by itself, that's not enough of a Shinoi, even though it's Nifsal Min HaMizbeach, even though it can't go on the Mizbeach. O Shaitai Yotzad Lissakel, or it's going out to be stoned. I can say, this is yours. This is the animal I took. Here's the animal back. Because all of these items are, we'll call them intangibles. They are not visible changes or obvious changes in the animal. And therefore, it's not considered enough of a shinui to be a kinyan. And so now the Gemara says, lo iskina, iskina mamash. When we say here that they aged in the Mishnah, it doesn't literally mean they aged. Elafilu kachasha. It's even if it weakened. So it's not that they aged, meaning in physical years they aged, but then they aged the equivalent of aging, which is that they became weaker. Doesn't the Mishnah say that they aged? If you wanted to say kachasha, say weakened.
So if he steals it now, 10 minutes from now it aged. So there is a kinyan
order. I think when we say iskina, we mean something that is a noticeable change in the item. That has to be something. Tosfot says that earlier. When it says, ba'avde zuze lokani, if you take metal and make it into a coin, that's not a kinyan, because he says, Dafka avde zuze, avalasamin anaska kli. If you made it into a utensil, then kani. Avagal dehadar avi le naska, even though you can melt it back to the original metal, to lo gorem nisarim vasan kelim. That's no different than boards that you make into a kli. Aval zuze vilevena ain't torat chashivut alehem. They're not significant enough of a change to be considered a kinyan. So Tosfot says that it's not just simply that something happened over here. You have to have a happening or some change that has significance, that either gains it a new name or it's noticeable. It has to be something of really significant quality. The other Rishonim will argue on that, Tosfot, and say that even if you take the metal and make it into a kli, since you can melt it back down again, it's still considered to be no shinoi. But Tosfot at least makes this distinction between what we'll call significant change and a small change or a small creation that you have over here. Small creations are not enough of a change. A big creation, even though it can be returned to its original state, is considered to be a kinyan because it's so significant what you did. And so you have to say the same thing over here. We're talking about aging. We don't talk about every day someone ages. We're not talking about that. We're talking about aging where the aging is noticeable. And we can prove that from what the Gemara says now, which is, why our mission says hiskina, then why would you say kachasha? The answer is, kachasha could go in hiskina. It's weakening like aging. Delohadar barya, but you don't get better again. So you see from here that the aging of the Mishnah is not simply that he got older. He's got older, which has an impact. His aging made him weaker. There is a significant difference in his ability to function now. So that's the type, and that's what it means. Kachasha is exactly that. weakening is a change in the productivity of the individual or the item. That can come about because they weakened, or that can come about because of age. And so what we're saying is that the weakening here is similar to aging. And that's why he says that it means kachasha. Amalei mark shisha brei derav chisla ravashi, achi kamarei mishmei derav yochanan, afilu ganav tlev nase ayo egov nase shor nase shinoi biado. That change in name, that aging is enough to be considered a change. So that's a noticeable change. I mean that these are significant enough changes. That's why it has a different name. It's because they have a significant change. So that's what he says. We actually quoted this in the Gemara above. And this was what we included. This scenario here. At that point in time, since he was koneh them, if he shechs them or he sells them after that point, he is considered to be the owner. It's his. And therefore, you don't pay dollar ve'ei. Haven't I told you already many times, don't get your memrot wrong. You're quoting it from the wrong person. When we quoted it above in the Gemara, we quoted in the name of Rabbi Yilah. He's quoting in the name of Rabbi Yochanan. And so Ravashi is chastising him and saying, be careful about your memrot. You have to say it over in the right name. Not that the memrot is wrong. You're right. What you're saying is correct. But you're quoting it from the wrong individual. And so he's chastising not from the memrot, but because he quoted it from Rabbi Yochanan instead of Rabbi Yilah. But what he's saying is true. That if an animal ages in the point where which the name changes, that name change already is considered enough of a shinoi to be a kinyan. Now, the significance of that is that there is a point of threshold. What you're noting is true, which is that sometimes when we talk about significant changes, like Tosafot talks about, where it's noticeable, or it's obvious, or it's significant, so that's easy to tell you all the difference between a lamb and a ayal and a ram, or a calf and a cow or an oxen. Those you can tell the difference between. But there is a point of threshold. For instance, a lamb is only known as a lamb in its first year of life, the first 12 months of its life. It becomes an ayo in the 13th month. I mean, there's an interim month where it's called a palges, but after that it turns into a ram. That means within a month's period it can switch from being a lamb to a ram. That small amount of time isn't so significant or obvious, the change. Nevertheless, the change in name is significant enough, meaning crossing that border is enough to be considered a shinoi, even though that may not be as noticeable at the exact point of the transition. Because a moment before it was this, the next moment it's not this. But you have to have a threshold somewhere. And therefore that threshold's enough to consider it a shinoi, even though at the moment of that change it's not as significant. But in a more general sense, there's a change between a lamb and a ram. All right, Rabbi Meir Omer, Bavadim Omer, Shalei Chav Lefanecha. Rabbi Meir says that he says, Arei Shalei Chav Lefanecha, because he deems it to be karka. I'm Rav Chanina Bar Avdimi, I'm a Rav Halocha Ki Rabbi Meir. Rav says the Locha is like Rabbi Meir. V'Rav Shavik Rabbanav Avin Ki Rabbi Meir? Why would Rav Paskin like a Dat Yachid of Rabbi Meir against the Chachamim? Doesn't make sense. Amrei Mishum de Breita Ipchotanya. Because we have a Breita that has it flipped. We have a Breita that has these positions reversed. And therefore this is the position of the Chachamim. The Gemara says, Rav Shavik Manitin Vavin Ki Breita? Why does Rav give up a Mishnah to a Breita? A Mishnah always has more authority than a Breita. And if the Mishnah says it in the name of Rabbi Meir, then it's in Rabbi Meir's name. You have a Breita that says the opposite, we would defer to the Mishnah over the Breita. Rav matnita nami ibchotani. Rav's Mishnah also had it flipped in it. The Gemara says, "My time of the Rav, the apich matnita become a Breita." So why did Rav reverse the position in our Mishnah because of a Breita? Other Rav, an apich the Breita become a matnita. Flip the positions in the Breita to match with the Mishnah. Why is he trying to match the Mishnah to the Breita? Have them Breita match the Mishnah. You're going backwards. So Rav nami matnita ibcha adne. So number one is that Rav didn't flip the Mishnah. That is the way that he learned the Mishnah, meaning that the Mishnah itself was, he originally had in that form. That's one answer. That was the way he was taught it. When we say that it's a Mishnah trumps a Breita, that's when it's one Mishnah versus one Breita. On the other hand, if you have one Mishnah and two Breitot that say differently, apich, they will trump the Mishnah. And that's over here, Rashi says, the first Breita we already quoted, because we said Rav flipped it because of a Breita. And now the Tanya, we're bringing you a second Breita. The Tanya, Machlif para bechamor v'yalda. Person is swaps, exchanges a para for chamor. This is a barter transaction. And the para was pregnant at the time and gives birth. V'chena mocher shivchato, someone who sold his shivcha, meaning for cash, v'yalda, and then she gives birth. Zeremer b'shuti yalda, v'ala shotek. One guy says it was born in my possession, meaning that you have a transaction. That we don't know where it was born. Was it born in the seller's possession, or was it born after the sale went through? So one guy says it was born in my possession. He says definitively. Bahalash shotek. And the other guy is silent. He doesn't say anything. Zocha ba. He's zoche in it. So Rashi says the reason is because you have a bari and shema. Bari and shema, bari, odif. Meaning that when you have a definitive claim and no claim or a shema claim, the bari always trumps. Tosfot says that's not definitive over here because you could claim over here it's not bari and shema, but rather bari and shtika. He's silent. Shtika kehoda. So even according to the one who says bari v'shema doesn't help you, nevertheless over here, because he didn't say shema, he's shotek, he was silent. That silence is acquiescence, and that's what makes it work over here. Then, zeomer eni yodea v'zeomer eni yodea. If they both say we don't know, yachloku. Then they split it. You have to assume here that it's not in either one of their possessions, so there's no chazak over here. Because if there was a chazak, you'd have to be motzi mechavereo ola v'raya. But since it's in neither of their possessions, then yachloku, because we have no way to know where it was born. Zeomer b'shuti, zeomer b'shuti. If they both make definitive claims about it, saying that it was born on my property, yishava mocher shebishuto yalda, then the seller takes a shvua that it was born in his possession. The fisha kol nishbaim shebatorah, nishbaim velo mishalmim, divrei Rabbi Meir. Because then everybody in the Torah, when it comes to a shvua, you take a shvua to release yourself from an obligation. Here the seller is trying to release himself from having the obligation to give this child or the born child to the buyer. Because it was born in his possession, so he doesn't want to give it. So he takes the shvuah to be patur from paying. Rashi actually says it's a case of modeh v'miksat. Because the lokeach is saying, I bought a shivcha with the vlad. And the other guy is saying, you bought a shivcha that was pregnant, but you didn't buy the vlad. So he calls it modeh v'miksat, and therefore it's a shvuah min haTorah. But according to Rabbi Meir, you take a shvuah here. Chachamim omrim, ein nishbaim, lo la'avadim, lo la'karkaot. Chachamim say that it's equivalent to karka. And just like on karka you don't take a shvuah, so too on an eved kanani you do not take a shvuah. So here you see the chachamim's position that an eved kanani is karka. So too, in our case, you would have to make the same conclusion that we're talking about an eved kanani being karka. So now, Rashi over here claims that this situation in the Braita is exact. It says you bartered animals and you paid cash for the shivcha. The reason being is because animals can be bought through a kinyan chalipin. And the shivcha can be bought by cash. The reason you want this is because you want it to be that it's in nobody's possession. Meaning that you want nobody to be around when this happens. So the shivcha, if you can buy a shivcha with cash, the shivcha doesn't have to be there when you buy it. The money does the kinyan. So that's why you can have a situation where the parties don't know if the shivcha gave birth before or after the transaction. Because the transaction was done away from the shivcha. Similarly, in a barter transaction, if you do a kinyan chalipin, where the guy takes possession of the chamor, and that automatically makes the para go into the possession of the other party. Over there, you have what's called a kinyan chalipin. That kinyan chalipin makes it that they weren't there when the para was acquired. Whereas Rashi says, if you bought it with money, then you would be there, because you would need a kinyan meshicha to complete the transaction, and that kinyan meshicha would make it that you were there when you did the meshicha. If you did the meshicha, the para was empty, meaning the birth already happened. Or the para still was pregnant, and you would know. So Rashi says the cases here are exact in order to make it a case where you can't see it. Tosfot, on the other hand, disagrees and says that it could be that either way, the cases aren't exact, but rather it's just a normal way that they're bought. Normally a shivcha is bought for cash, and normally animals are bartered in this manner, but not that that is the absolute way it has to be in these scenarios. Even if it wasn't that way, the case would also work out. Then Tosfot goes on to understand, or try to understand, how do the Rabbanan view avadim in other circumstances? Does that mean by gezel and kinyanim, it's also the same din? Or do we separate the dinim? And this is what I told you before. There's a lot of tension here in avadim being like karka. Even if you believe that avadim are like karka, that may not be everywhere. That may be in some cases or some situations or where there's gzeret dekatub. Because in the end, avadim are still movable, mobile objects and they're not karka. And so how much they're deemed to be like karka will depend maybe on the dat of the Tana, the Amora, or even on the dat of the Rishon, not always say exclusively where you say it either is or isn't. It's not like that. It's not binary in that way. And Tosfot is discussing those distinctions. Umar says, "Hi, halacha k'Rabbi Meir, halacha k'Rabbanan mibayle." Why are you saying the halacha is like Rabbi Meir then? Rav should say the halacha is like the Rabbanan, because he has the Mishnah flipped. He should say the halacha is like the Rabbanan. Hachi kamar, lamai dafchitu v'tanitu halacha k'Rabbi Meir. The way that your Mishnah appears with it as the opinion of Rabbi Meir, there the halacha is like Rabbi Meir. I have it as being the Rabbanan, but you have it as Rabbi Meir. So I'm going to say halacha Rabbi Meir, so you understand what I'm saying based on my Mishnah or the Braito that convinced me that the Mishnah was incorrect. Okay, we're going to stop here on the bottom of Tzadik Vav Amud Bet.